This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for October 1st, 2020, the What We Will Know on Election Night edition. I am David Plotz in Washington, D.C. In the closet, I am joined by Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School from her home in New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hey, David. Hey, John.
And by John Dickerson of CBS's 60 Minutes from his home in Manhattan, New York City. Hello, John.
Hello, David. Hello, Emily.
On today's Gabfest, Trump's taxes, the fallout from the debate, the state of the polls. What will the debate? What will Trump's taxes? What will the reshaping of the debate format mean for the race and for American democracy? Then we're going to be joined by Nate Persley, who is a leading authority on voting, on boards of elections, on how people vote, how votes are counted, and the law, to tell us what we are going to know on election night and what we will not know on election night. Then the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to be a Supreme Court justice. What kind of justice would she be? Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. If you are still feeling battered by Tuesday night, or you're still feeling battered by this week, you are not alone. This is a week that has been really extraordinary. We've had so many extraordinary weeks in the Trump presidency. This has been a real big one. The debate, the shocking refusal of the president to denounce white supremacists, the shocking attack by the president on the mechanism of the election, his claim that it's already a fraudulent election, the attempt by the president to destroy the format of the debate and the recognition that the presidential debate, next debates need to be rejiggered, all are top of mind. But also top of mind is this amazing, amazing feat of reporting by the New York Times, which obtained through some means most of the president's personal tax records and other kinds of tax records over the past, 18 years.
Up to 2018.
These tax records show an amazing pattern of tax avoidance and cheating, as well as possibly profound incompetence in business. And they are almost impossible for regular people to understand because they're just so complicated, and what they reveal is so confusing. Listeners familiar with the highlights know that the president paid $750 a year in income tax for his first couple of years as president, zero in most previous years of personal income tax. He had businesses that appear to have been run with either devilish incompetence or with the express purpose of losing money. And the express purpose of losing money, perhaps, according to people I've talked to, for the purpose of laundering money. There are a whole bunch of deeply shady payments to family members for unspecified consulting services, mysterious money that is paid to who knows where. There's an extremely suspect $72 million tax refund that the government paid Trump back, and he's now being audited around. And then there's $420 million in personal debts that are about to come due. So, John, we have been waiting for these taxes for 5 years. They are shocking. The level of chaos, chicanery, dishonesty, and sheer kind of confusion that they reveal. The overwhelming feeling, of course, that I had is that, to me, a taxpayer who has paid a lot of taxes, a lie paid many multiples of what Trump did in personal income taxes last year, as I'm sure you both did, it is just insulting that he goes to such efforts to cheat us out of paying for all the services the government has provided to its citizens and to the government that he presides over, to have cheated them out of the money that they should have gotten. That was my overwhelming feeling, but maybe that wasn't your feeling.
Well, I don't know what my feeling was. John Sides, political scientist, points out in the wake of this that the studies show basically that this is something people care about, which is to say they don't like when people cheat. And what interested me about that was a lot of energy in the Republican Party, and particularly energy that was accessed by President Trump, revolves around this idea that Democrats promote policies that allow other people to cheat and get things. This is what the kind of the Obama phones myth was about. The idea that, you know, somehow other people are kind of grafting off the federal government and I'm not getting mine or nobody's paying attention to me. And this, I feel like, is a part of that. There was some, I don't know what the evidence is now, but it certainly undermines the initial claim in 2016 from the president that he was a smart businessman. I think obviously the president's base think he's a great businessman, and this is proof of his skill, which is his, you know, he's getting around paying taxes. But the key distinction you made is that it's one thing to be aggressive in your taxes. It's another to engage in activity to create fraudulent conditions to take advantage of the tax code. And that's what is alleged here. My particular favorite was, I mean, not favorite, but the thing that struck me particularly was the Westchester property that he has, that he claims it's a part of the company in order to deduct the property taxes, when the property tax limitations of his recent tax bill skewered people with just the kinds of properties that he has found another way to hide from paying taxes on.
Yeah, he says it's basically a Trump organization property, even though his family, his kids say, oh, it's a family compound, that they're using it for personal purposes. Emily, one of the distinctions I think that's important to note is that Trump, all rich people attempt to minimize their taxes. They practice tax avoidance schemes of various sorts. But at least according to what the Times revealed, this is on a much grander scale. Trump is paying far, far, far less in taxes than other kinds of rich people who are comparable to him. He is exceptionally greedy and sneaky about it.
Wait, I am interested in why you're using the word confusing. I didn't think this was confusing. I thought there were three, like, big things that stood out in it. One is, this is a man who has an incredibly lavish lifestyle and presents that way and is paying tiny, tiny amounts in income tax. The second is that he owes between $300 and $4 million. We don't know to whom, and it's coming due soon. And we don't know how that affects weird, kind of difficult to understand policy decisions he's made in dealing with countries like Russia, Turkey, and the Philippines, places where he has big investments, and maybe that is actually driving American policy. Who knows? And then the third thing is this $72 million tax relief he took from the IRS over an Atlantic City partnership interest. So now I'm going to read, because I don't have complete mastery of this facts, but there's this good piece from Daniel Shaviro in Just Security. And he says that he, as a lawyer, handled a tax dispute just like this for a client. And that actually, like, the law is pretty clear on this, because what you're supposed to do when you owe equity, like this kind of partnership interest that has lost enormous value, if you sell it for an enormous loss, then that's only a capital loss, according to Shaviro. And the deduction you're allowed to take is limited to the sum of A, net capital gains for the year, and B, $3,000. You're only allowed to carry it forward at $3,000 a year, normally. It's only if the investment is utterly worthless and you abandon it for zero consideration, according to Shaviro, does it become an ordinary loss. And that's how Trump categorized this loss. And that's why he took this $72 million piece of tax relief. But the thing is, he received back a 5% interest. So because Donald Trump continued to get this 5% right. interest, he didn't abandon this asset from Atlantic City. And he looks like wasn't entitled to the $72 right. million dollar right. refund he took from the government.
Emily, I would just wait. I mean, that's why it's confusing, Emily.
Yeah, can I mean, just say
and,
two things?
And also, can I say, and also, like, I think what's confusing, like, sorry, what I think is confusing is not what those three things you pointed out are very important. To me, there's a fundamental existential confusion in this, which is Trump a really terrible businessman? Which is the way the Times presented it, which is that he owns all these businesses, they operate at a huge loss every year, and he's taking a bunch of loans out, and he's still managing to float a lavish lifestyle by somehow getting money out. Or there's a wholly other theory, which is he may be a mediocre businessman. He's clearly not a great businessman, but that there's some significant crime that is happening. Adam Davidson had a great tweet thread about looking at one Trump golf course and the totally confounding, mysterious ways they've done the accounting and taxation and valuation of that golf course, which everyone who looks at it, who's a tax expert, looks at it as like the only explanation for this is it's a form of money laundering. So is there something which isn't Trump is a bad businessman going on that explains why he is able to have all this money and not ever pay any taxes, and and yet these businesses appear to be operating at huge losses?
Well, I think that he's working a scheme to go back to Emily's $72 million refund from the IRS. The first thing is he got the refund, which means that what he's wrestling over is giving up money that's been given to him. So at the very least, a protracted, complicated, anything to hold off a judgment from the IRS is in his interest because he's gotten the $72 million back, as opposed to arguing for something to then get the IRS to give him the $72 million. He won in the short game. Now he's playing the long game. But so he's played that angle. Then he's used that angle, the $72 million dispute with the IRS, which is ongoing, as a way to shield his taxes, because he said, I'm going to be the first president since Nixon not to release my tax returns because they're under audit. So he's using the one dispute to take care of another dispute that's in his life. And so I think that's a way in which you see him using the system. And it's sort of similarly to the way he quiets people by threatening lawsuits. He's playing the angles to take care of these various issues. And I think he just keeps doing that. At least this is what the Times reporting makes you feel, is that he keeps doing that to kind of stay one step ahead of the tax man. And that also is connected, it seems to me, that to why this is the reporting is interesting, which is that staying in office will keep him ahead of the tax man. It will keep him ahead of these debts because he's president of the United States. And so, you know, will the banks push him for the obligations he owes, or will they find some way to roll it over or deal with it? Because they're dealing with the president of the United States. They're not going to slap a notice on his door and say you're in foreclosure. And then the final thing is, because of the position outlined by the Times, which suggests that his properties are losing a great deal of money, it then further explains why every time he goes somewhere, he stays at one of his properties. I mean, he's basically doing marketing for those properties to try to put them back on their feet if you follow where the Times reporting says they are.
And taking investments from people in Russia, Turkey, and the Philippines. Here's my concise summary of Daniel Shaviro's point in Just Security. With these Atlantic City partnership interests, he claimed a total loss and this huge $72 million amount of tax relief, or something where he took a 5% interest in the new entity that was being created. And that is not how these losses are supposed to work, according to tax lawyers. They're supposed to only be taken going forward if you have a total loss, not if you get something in exchange. And so, you know, it looks to Shaviro like Trump should lose this audit. And that goes back to your point, John, like, what does it mean to have the president under this kind of audit? And is this part of why he is so desperate to win the election, because he has this huge potential tax bill coming due, and then all these outstanding loans that, like, we don't know how he's going to prevent foreclosure.
Well, we do know how he's going to prevent foreclosure if he's president, which is that there are going to be some quiet conversations with banks. And look, I wonder what kind of possible favors these banks are going to get, what kind of favorable tax treatment, what ways we're going to look away about problems these banks are having in other places, in order that the president's loans get extended, get refinanced at some sort of favorable rate somehow, or maybe they're bought by somebody. Maybe somebody buys these properties at slightly over market, and I wonder what that person's going to get out of it. It is very clear that the president will use his office to make sure that $420 million is not something he actually has to pay out, because he can't, because he doesn't have the cash. He can't do it.
And of course, this is why it's so important for us to understand all of this. This is why hiding the tax returns to begin with is a problem, because we need to understand these connections.
Would you think it would have mattered had we seen these in 2015, Emily?
That's a good question. I mean, it would have undermined a lot of his argument for both his I'm a great business person and I'm not going to have conflicts of interest going forward. So, yeah, I think it might have mattered. What do you think, John?
Well, I think two things. One, as you were saying, we have to know these things. I mean, this all came out of Richard Nixon saying, you know, the American people have to know whether their president is a crook. When Nixon released his tax returns, as I recall, it was in fact determined that he had to pay back taxes. And I think he paid something like $400,000
yep.
back taxes, which was no small amount. And it didn't hurt him politically. So then that's
he did pay back, though.
Right. But it didn't hurt him politically. I guess the second point I would make is, the voters knew extraordinary things about candidate Donald Trump. The things he had said out loud, the things he had been heard to say on audio. If they knew nothing else about him, they knew the most damaging things about him, and they still elected him.
Yep. I think that's right. I don't think that had these taxes come out in 2015 or 2016, it would have made significant difference in the sense that I think it would have reinforced a narrative, which is, man, this is a guy who's so clever. It would have been affirming of a narrative rather than contravening it. And it seems clear, like I was reading in one of the articles we were looking at, that people who support Trump believe he is a good businessman, no matter what you tell them, what evidence is presented, because his lifestyle is of a rich person. And it's very hard to dissuade people from thinking, oh, this rich guy is a good businessman, because he presents, he tells you all the time. And if you are inclined to believe it, you'll just continue to believe it. So I don't think it was,
but
I don't think the evidence would have.
You might think he owes more than $750 a year. And maybe it's a little disconcerting that he's deducting $70,000 for his hair.
Yeah, it's for you and me, it's disgusting and vile. But I'm not sure that it was that for the people who were going to vote for him, that is a shaker. I there's nothing that makes me think they matter politically right now.
Right.
But I mean, as a citizen, we should be. Yeah, it's horrifying to think that the president owes $420 million to God knows who, and that the president is malforming and misshaping the IRS to protect a tax interest of his own. That is truly disturbing. But I'm not sure that it's. And John, maybe you have a better sense of this. I'm not sure it's disturbing at the level of this will affect the race on the margins.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could, given the freneticism and haze and all kinds of intervening events, including the debates, you can imagine that this wouldn't actually matter that much with respect to the campaign. I mean, what it does do is it's one more. You know, he already is trudging up the hill behind Joe Biden, beset by stories about calling, fallen soldiers losers and suckers and then a bad debate performance. This is one more brick in the backpack that he's got to lug up the hill. So in that sense, it's takes him off his game. He has to talk about in his debate response to the question about the $750. When the country already thoroughly, his honesty and trustworthiness ratings are in the 30s, I think, still. So when he speaks now, it's different than when he spoke before. And so when he makes excuses, people pretty much think he's not telling the truth, if you believe those polls. So it could matter, but I think there's just so much going on, it's hard to know. I must say one other thing is that we talked on the special after the debate about the white supremacy remarks, and the Republican leaders have now had to call out Donald Trump three different times for being slow-footed on calling out white supremacy.
Slow-footed?
For a person.
John.
What's that?
Slow-footed? He's not slow-footed. He's like, he's...
Well, if you let me finish the sentence. In the debate, Wallace said, would you call out white supremacists? And he said, yes. So he didn't say nothing. The point is that that's totally and completely and 1,000% not meeting the moment. So the point is, what the Republicans have said is, they've had a mild slap on the wrist about this. My point is that it causes the whole party to have to behave in a certain way to cover up for what he's been doing with respect to the taxes, to minimize it, to, as North Dakota Senator Kevin Cramer once, when told that Trump was going to have the G7 at his golf course in Miami, said, well, it may seem careless politically, but on the other hand, there's a tremendous integrity in his boldness and his transparency. In other words, people have to say crazy stuff to explain this away. And so that's a way in which, just like with the white supremacy stuff, it's splashing up on lots of other people in the party, which creates political damage outside of the president's fortunes.
Before we leave this topic, well, it's not really this topic, before we leave, but we're sort of talking about the state of the race, John, and the debate. The debate obviously was this rat fuck of an evening, because the president just refused to behave in anything other than a childish and grotesquely bullying way. And it sounds like the Commission on Presidential Debates is going to make some changes as we are taping on Thursday morning. That appears to be happening. Do you know what is going to happen? Do you have any sense about what they're going to do to alter the format of the next two presidential debates?
We think there's going to be something like a cutting off the microphone or something like that, which is an extraordinary thing because the president was unable to control himself because the president was so honking and interrupting. They're having to rewrite the rules, which is just an extraordinary thing in the first place. Second thing is, you know, basically the Commission on Presidential Debates has discovered norms and that they don't sometimes work. But as a practical matter, it's real tricky. For the moderator, it adds just one more thing, because sometimes when somebody interrupts, it's a useful interjection. Sometimes in the nature of, as you and as the three of us do, you actually learn something through an exchange. So how do you know when to hit the button? It'll be interesting to see how they figure that out.
Some wise person was suggesting to me that maybe they could fade the other person out. And was that you?
Didn't I make that suggestion in the debate?
Maybe that's right.
But
how do you fade if what they're basically doing is interjecting? Like, an interjection is intrinsically a thing that happens very rapidly, very exclamatorily, and is quick and is over. Like, there's no time to fade that. It's not that Trump interrupts and goes on Fidel Castro-like perorations for 4 hours.
No, he did that too, actually.
Yeah, both. He did.
You have a point, though. And now I'm interrupting you successfully.
Yes. But will the GABFest listeners who complain every time I interrupt you note that you interrupted me? No, they won't.
No, I win the interruption game.
You get
game.
To interrupt. Slate Plus members get bonus segments on the GABFest and other Slate podcasts. And they also get all kinds of other benefits of membership. And at this incredibly difficult, important time in American life, Slate is doing great journalism. They're doing great coverage of the election, of some of the issues around voting, of some of the issues around race and equity and the national protests. And your support as a Slate Plus member makes a real difference in the quality of what Slate can do and what it can convey to you as a reader and a listener. And we really appreciate your support. And you can go to slate.com/GABFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today if you want. And we will have a bonus segment today where we're going to talk about what if we were running a business into the ground to gain tax to as part of a tax dodge, how would we do it? What business would we destroy in order to gain some advantage on our taxes if we were a lavishly rich, wealthy person who could afford to do such a thing? So go to slate.com/GABFestPlus. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
We are joined now by Nate Persley. He is the James B. McClatchy Professor of Law at Stanford Law School, and he is an expert in American election law, what is called the law of democracy, around issues such as voting rights, political parties, campaign finance, redistricting, and election administration. As you can imagine, these are important issues right now. Nate, thanks for joining us on the GABFest. And I want to start with a piece you co-wrote this week for the Wall Street Journal, which I think for people who read it may have tamped down a lot of the fear that some people, especially on the left, have about how chaotic this election could be. Were you trying to tamp down fear? And what was the point of the piece, which was sort of like what we're going to know on election night?
Yes, we were trying to tamp down fear. I think that it is possible we are going to have an election meltdown scenario. It is possible that we have all of the regime-threatening action that people are worried about. But that is less likely than not. And I think that we need to be sort of clear-eyed about what the likely outcomes are. And most importantly, we wanted to emphasize that on election night, we will know a lot that it's not as if we will be in the dark for weeks as to who won this election. Even if it's a close election, we're going to have a lot of information from places like Florida, Texas, North Carolina, Maine, New Hampshire on election night. And so we'll be able to make a good guess as to whether someone clearly won this election or whether we're in one of those meltdown scenarios.
Can you specifically give an example from one of those states, maybe Florida, because I think you delved into that most deeply in the piece about what maybe the fears are and why those fears are perhaps overblown and what we will know about Florida on election night.
So
Florida has a bad history on election night. I remember 2000.
So the meltdown scenario that everybody has in mind is that we will not know who won on election day or election night because we'll have so many absentee ballots that are outstanding, and those will be determinative of the outcome. And so then it'll be left up to the lawyers over the succeeding weeks to argue about those absentee ballots, and you know, the president will claim fraud, and then there'll be a debate about that. But actually, there are some states like Florida that begin processing their absentee ballots 3 weeks before the election. And so we should have most of the ballots, and when I say most, I mean well over 95% of the ballots from Florida by Wednesday morning counted. And as a result of that, we can make some inferences not only as to who won Florida, but how Biden and Trump are doing around the country. It's not as if we will just be guessing as to the state of play come Wednesday morning. We'll have a lot of information from a lot of states. I mean, we'll have well over 100 million ballots that will probably have been counted by Wednesday morning. And so we'll have a good guess as to who's doing well in which parts of the country.
I really liked this line in your piece, Nate. The media are right to brace the public for a week or more of counting, but preaching patience is different from predicting chaos. So as you're looking ahead, the states I'm the most worried about, I think, from following your work are Michigan, Wisconsin, and especially Pennsylvania, because I think I'm right that they are not going to count their mail-in ballots before Election Day. So how much does that matter? I mean, if Florida is clear and decided, and I guess especially if Biden wins, then that would send a strong signal. Ohio will also count early. But if Trump wins Florida and Ohio, and we don't know the results in those other three swing states, and maybe Arizona, like, what does that mean? Are there places we can look in those states that will indicate what happened? Who won?
So there are two things. First of all, if we have the same election in 2020 that we had in 2016, then we're in for the long haul, because that election came down to Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, and these were small margins in each of those states. And so absentee ballots would clearly be outcome determinative, and then we would have the expected litigation and arguing over those ballots. But as you said, it's not as if we will know nothing about those states, either on election night or shortly thereafter. And so we'll have some results from some counties. And one of the most important things that I think the media can do is to not just simply report the results, but in the fully reported counties to compare how Trump is doing in 2020 to 2016, because that'll give us an indication as to how similar the result is going to be to the 2016 election and whether he is doing as well or better or worse. Certainly by Wednesday morning, we will have most of Michigan that will probably be reporting. We will have some counties probably in the middle of Pennsylvania. Philadelphia is still probably going to be quite late, and some counties in Wisconsin. So we won't have to wait a week before we have any news from those counties. We'll have a good idea of sort of who's winning that state.
And Nate, let me see if I can misinterpret what you're saying or get it right so you can affirm it. So if you talk about Berks County, Pennsylvania, so the thing people should watch for is counties, not just whether they're going for one candidate or another, but if several counties in which Donald Trump won by 10 points in 2016, he's only winning by 3 points in 2020, and it's many different counties across a state, even if the results aren't in for the state, you can't write a narrative of fraud when you have the same smaller margins in all the places you would expect him to run big across the state. In terms of making those early inferences, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
That's right. So first, you couldn't make an inference of fraud. But secondly, we also have to make sure that the media doesn't hold back that information when claims of fraud are made, so that And normally when we think of how reports are done on election night, we think of like percent of precincts reporting as the way that we look at it. That's a mistake, as well as just reporting the data as it comes in. It's because the president is going to get most of the in-person votes on election day. If you simply report those votes as they come in, then it's going to lead to what we call a red mirage, right? So that it looks like the Republicans are winning on election night, and then that would be followed by a blue shift, which is as the absentee ballots come in. But the key is to report how the president, and for that matter, how Biden is doing in fully reported or nearly fully reported counties as compared to 2016 to see whether there's a shift from, you know, who won 4 years ago.
Actually, I want two questions here. One is,
I want three.
I got four.
Yeah, I know. You took two questions the first time. I didn't just follow up because I'm following the damn norms.
Well, sucker. We know how well that's loser. Gone for everybody. I'm going to follow up your question, John, which is, do you get the sense that the media is aware of the behavior? Have they been trained enough to know that this is how they should behave? Or do you get the sense that oh no, they're going to be reporting, you know, in this half-assed way, as they have perhaps in elections past.
Especially on CBS, it's going to be super half-assed.
Is there anybody from CBS here who could maybe be active on election night who could take this message to them? I don't think they've made the transition yet. This is our next op-ed, actually, is how to report the results. Everybody follows the lead of the Associated Press in general, and the Associated Press is going to be, as I understand it, reporting out results, but they're going to take the same approach that they have historically, which is that they're going to, you know, wait to do a call on election night or the day after or the week after based on the evidence that they have from both the exit polls and, of course, and mostly the actual results. But I have not seen any change yet among the decision desks or the networks that they are going to follow this lead. But I'm confident that they're going to do something different. The reason we wrote that op-ed is because the thing that I worry about is that there's going to be an information void in the 24 hours or 48 hours after the election, which will be filled by disinformation and false claims of victory. And so because the message has been sent that the media needs to hold back and wait till they really know who the winner is, that then I'm concerned that just allows the bad actors to be the most amplified voices.
All right, I'll just take one question. Sorry.
That was a long answer there. So sorry.
No, that was a good answer. So I want to talk a little bit about litigation. We are all hoping this won't happen. But if there is a lot of contestation going on in one or more of these swing states, do we have to worry about whether the counting can be completed in time for the state to make the safe harbor of December 8th for reporting their electors?
The statute says that you have to have your process in place and completed by December 8th of this year. Okay. And so if you have selected your electors by December 8th, then that will be the presumptive slate that should be taken as the legitimate slate from the state when the House of Representatives sort of looks at the ballots on January 6th.
One of the concerns, and I'm now channeling another law professor, Jed Sugarman, is that you could just gum up the works and not finish the counting of the mail-in ballots because they can be challenged individually, and that in itself could derail the count in a key state.
Well, that strategy and that scenario is certainly out there. I think it's unlikely. The states are prepared for this, and I put sort of quotes around prepared, which is that they have recount processes and they have, laws in place to deal with contestation. While it, you know, may be that we won't have all the ballots counted, we'll have enough of them counted by the safe harbor deadline of the Electoral Count Act that we will, you know, have a sense as to who won each one of the states. But there are lots of different ways that the candidates could delay things. They can challenge voters and their eligibility. They can challenge the ballots before they are counted, for example, challenging signatures on absentee ballots or whether they were late or not. then they can, of course, challenge the count and contest the outcome, which is what we saw in 2000 in Bush versus Gore. And you may remember in that situation that we also had sort of extra legal means. There was the famous Brooks Brothers riot outside the Miami-Dade County Canvassing Board, where you had sort of, you know, a band of folks that were supporting President Bush that were disrupting the count. And you could think that those kinds of actions might be more likely this time around. And let alone the fact that, President Trump and Donald Trump Jr. has asked people to enlist in a poll-observing force, right, that would go into the polling places. So, I mean, the point is that there are lots of ways to mess with the election infrastructure that could delay things and could lead to litigation.
And, Nate, can you just on that point help people understand the difference between poll watchers, which I understand it are a normal and healthy part of our functioning democracy, and what Don Jr. and the president are encouraging with respect to people, you know, kind of quote unquote monitoring the voting and stopping suspicious looking people?
Well, that's right. There's a fine but important line between observation and intimidation. And so you have people who are perfectly entitled to make sure that, you know, there's not fraud going on in the polling place and that people are fairly being treated. I mean, if you go back and think about how, you know, the NAACP wants to observe the polls in the South in order to make sure, you know, historically that African-Americans weren't disenfranchised and the like. But then, of course, if you have armies of people who are trying to look over the shoulders of voters as they vote, or to question the eligibility of every voter as he or she comes in, well, that's you know, that moves from observation to intimidation. Now, Pennsylvania, like other states, have laws about what is a sort of suitable election observer, and so sometimes they are, you know, pre-authorized and appointed by the parties, and so you know who is an official election observer.
And sometimes they have to be from the precinct, which could make a real difference in cities like Philadelphia.
Yeah, well, not only that, we actually have the Pennsylvania Supreme Court issuing a decision, now it's about 2 weeks ago, saying that election observers, that the law in Pennsylvania is upheld, that election observers have to live in the county in which they're going to be observing.
Can I just jump in here and quickly ask about Arizona? Because you mentioned that Florida starts 22 days before the election and counting. I think Arizona starts 18 or something. Is Arizona another one of those states that we should keep an eye on in terms of having been through this enough before that they might have a kind of durable count from which we can draw conclusions election night?
Well, we will see. I actually was had the head of elections for Maricopa County talk to my class the other day. We investigated this.
It's Maricopa County, Phoenix. Just
that's
for
Phoenix, yeah. Right? Okay. So, which is ends up being
80% well of the vote or something.
Yeah, a huge amount of the vote. And he said, "Look, we're going to have to be patient." I actually think Arizona will take a longer time than some of the other states that we're talking about. And so we should not expect to have results from Arizona in the 48 hours afterwards unless there's, you know, a considerable victory.
Do you get any sense that are there any of the swing states where the officials who are supervising the election are in fact vulnerable to being deeply swayed by some of the arguments that Trump is making and could really distort how the election is carried out or how the vote count is carried out in such a way that people in that state should worry?
Well, one of the good things about sort of our situation right now as compared to, say, 4 years ago or even 8 years ago is that in most of the battleground states, we have divided government, right? So that in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, you have Democratic governors and you have Republican legislatures, and you actually have Democratic attorney generals in most of those states and Democratic secretaries of state, so that there is some kind of counterbalance to what would be sort of overexertions of federal authority or other manipulations of the process. Similarly, as you go down to the local level, and I can't sort of stress this enough, these issues do not have the same partisan valence as they do at the national level. So if you talk to local election officials, as I've been doing over the last 6 months, you know, issues like vote by mail are not controversial among Republican election officials at the local level. And so they just want to, you know, process these ballots and get people so that there aren't long lines in the polling place. So that's a long answer to saying that I don't think the local officials are going to be swayed by a lot of these issues or a lot of these forces. There are situations in which state officials might be, because the Secretary of States are naturally going to be a little more political than the local officials. But we do have checks and balances in most of the battleground states.
What are you advising people about making plans to vote? Do you think that voting in person early is better if you live in a state that does that, because then your ballot could actually be counted early and would not be part of this later wave of ballot counting? Do you think that people should feel fine about voting by mail? Does it just depend where you live? How are you supposed to decide that?
Well, I do think that voting early in person is the best thing for people to do. And the reason I believe that is because if you vote early in person, that ends up putting the least stress on election administrators, because it means that those votes have been banked early and there's been no issue of transmission or chain of custody through the mail and the like. But whatever you do, you need to vote early. If you're voting by mail, you need to turn it in right now. If you're voting early, go to a polling place in person. And then if you're voting on election day, try to go in the off hours, which would be in the middle of the day instead of when there's the rush at the beginning of the day or at the end.
Nate, tell me what I should think or not think at all about the Purcell Doctrine.
Whoa.
Awesome. Woo.
I have no idea what's being
John
said.
John Dickerson.
Well, I'm just going to let Nate explain it so I don't confuse people, and then he has to unconfuse them.
Not to be confused with the Purcell Doctrine, is that right?
Yeah.
So the Purcell Doctrine stands for the proposition, and comes from a case actually out of Arizona, the Purcell case, which says that, you know, last-minute changes to election law should not be allowed, whether those are made by the courts or whether they're made by state actors. And so if in the next month we have a local court that makes a radical change to election law, the Purcell Doctrine would suggest that on appeal that the court might stay that and allow the process to work itself out. And the reason that that doctrine exists is because one of the most important things when it comes to election administration is to have settled expectations. And while the Democrats, for example, have won a lot of important voting rights victories in the last few weeks in court, if you have the courts going back and forth and there's sort of uncertainty as to what the rules are, that's the worst case scenario. And
Wisconsin primary in April 2020.
Well, that's right. We could be there pretty soon in Pennsylvania, frankly, because the Republicans have now appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's decision there, dealing with issues like deadlines and the like. And so the most important thing is we actually have rules in place, and so then the parties and campaigns can sort of work around them. And so there's a point at which in the next week or two, the music needs to stop and that we need to have the rules set for how the candidates and campaigns are going to run.
Nate Persily is the McClatchy Professor of Law at Stanford Law School. Nate, thank you so much. This was really, really interesting and useful. And I hope maybe you can come back as we're even closer to Election Day to give us a little bit more update.
You bet. Thank you.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Barring a remarkable turn of events, Amy Coney Barrett will be a Supreme Court justice. She will take the seat formerly held by Ruth Bader Ginsburg and solidifying what was already a pretty solid conservative majority on the Supreme Court. Republicans have the votes to approve her. John, what ways can Democrats gum up this process or slow the process, and can they slow it down enough to push the vote past the election? We've heard about these 2-hour rule for committee meetings. You can delay a committee vote by a week, various other things. How much of those can they do? Will they do? And how much will it matter?
Nothing happens in the Senate for without a quorum. So you can do a quorum call. You can deny recess. You can there are a whole bunch of procedural things they could do to try to delay. The problem is they have to decide how much to push and then how much they would lose, you know, potentially lose somebody like Joe Manchin in the court of public opinion. And then the question is, what's the goal? Because they're going to lose. So is the goal to kick the vote till after the election, or is it to just make enough of a stink that you pay, that you show your important constituencies which care about the issues that Barrett is on the other side of, that you show them you're at least working hard to try to, like, be concerned in public. And I don't know what the choice will be there. But I think based on my reading of everything, there's nothing they can do. And so then it's just a question of timing.
Emily, should Democrats in the Senate meet with her? Should they show up to question her? Should they be at the hearing, given what happened with Merrick Garland?
So I find myself unable to care very much about any of this. I don't care at all whether they meet with her. I know, like, seriously, it just doesn't matter in the end. Like, I think they need to do something to demonstrate to their base that this is not normal. Not because confirming a justice before an election is not normal, but because the Republicans said that was not normal with Merrick Garland, and this is a reversal. Beyond that, I just don't think it matters very much. I don't think it matters whether they meet with her. The questioning her, I actually think there is some value in challenging her and getting her on the record in the hearings. And so I don't really think the idea that they shouldn't show up is the way that they should demonstrate that they think a norm is being violated here.
And I'd like to, based on what Emily said, amend my response, which is that there is a presidential election year benefit that comes from using the heat of Supreme Court nominations to talk about the Affordable Care Act, both with respect to Emily's point about questioning and also with the electoral benefit that gives Democrats in the presidential election. If the Democrats are able to use this whole process to create a huge national debate about healthcare and the Affordable Care Act, I think that serves their larger electoral presidential benefits. And by the way, also works with respect to the court too, in a process where they have limited leverage.
So she's obviously, like, been an excellent professor. She gets really great ratings from her students. She's smart. She's well-liked by her students.
Yes.
You know, she seems to be she's like a human being who seems to have led a good life. She has firm commitments. She is a woman of strong faith, obviously.
She adopted two kids.
That's a very good thing to do. But I personally, I don't have much to say about her views. I cannot stand the way the Supreme Court has become this home just for people who are law professors, who basically live in this incredibly rarefied world. And she is yet another one. With Brett Kavanaugh, we had a tiny reprieve from it, because Brett Kavanaugh did spend a little bit of his life in more in the humdrum and give and take of politics in the Bush White House and in the Ken Starr's office. But basically, all we're getting are these lawyers who are either just, like, extremely specific appellate lawyers like John Roberts or law professors. And where are the politicians? Where are the people who've lived? Where are the people who've, like, been criminal defense attorneys? Where are the people who've, like, had to run for office? Like, where are the Sandra Day O'Connors? Where are the Earl Warrens? It's just it just is tiresome to have a court that is simply made up of people who come from this tiny little cabal, and where all you ever do is talk about legal theory with other legal theorists.
Yes, it's very insular. I think that's absolutely right. One thing that's interesting about Judge Barrett is I would argue that we know more about her views on the controversial issues than we've known about the last bunch of nominees. She's on the record about being much more willing to overturn past decisions the court has made than other justices were at their hearings. I mean, Justice Thomas has taken this position that basically, if you are a judge who professes to interpret the Constitution based on its original meaning and you think there's a decision that's not in line with that, then you just overturn it. I mean, this is not a consistently upheld principle because there are these huge bodies of case law in the American courts that conservatives also like that have nothing to do with the original meaning of the Constitution. I'm thinking of things like unlimited donations for corporations based on the First Amendment on the conservative side, or Brown versus Board of Education on the liberal side, and or at the time unanimous, actually. It's not a consistently held principle, but the idea that Barrett is really willing to be so clear about overturning precedent, of course, has big implications for Roe versus Wade and lots of other areas of law that involve, like, the role of the federal government and how federal agencies write regulations, how Congress legislates. So I think that stuff is a big deal, and I hope we get... Yes, attention to the Affordable Care Act, because she's also on the record as having been totally skeptical of Chief Justice John Roberts' rationale for upholding its constitutionality a few years ago. And we have another Affordable Care Act case on the docket in November, not to do with the Constitution, but really important for whether that law continues or not. And then we have Second Amendment issues with gun rights that she's on the record, like, in which she seems much more willing to strike down state and local gun laws than even Justice Scalia was in writing the majority opinion in Heller that started us down this road of an individual right to bear arms in the Second Amendment. There's just a lot of actual legal fodder. And normally nominees kind of dance around that at these hearings. And maybe she'll do that too. But because there are these clear statements, it could actually be more of a debate.
Emily, another question for you around that, which is that former judge, Michael McConnell?
Yeah.
Wrote about Barrett that how could we, you know, this is not going to be a big deal for the court. It's not going to tip the court in any direction. No reason to think that she's likely to overturn Roe. I mean, he's a conservative former judge. But is there any reason to think that she would not be a fifth vote to overturn Roe?
No, I really struggled with that piece because we are talking about a very conservative replacement for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was one of the chief liberals on the court. And so there is just a big switch going on. It's not like for like. It's opposite for opposite. And it is true that there is already a fairly solid conservative majority on the court. It is also true that in a few key cases, Chief Justice John Roberts has kind of looked for some sort of like ballast in the middle as a swing voter. He's not a moderate, but he's not willing to go as far and as fast as the other four conservatives have been in the last two terms. And there's no reason to think Barrett is going to join him there. She is absolutely like the Federalist Society's choice, this arch-conservative group that has been incredibly successful at grooming judges for the Supreme Court, like, she's their person. So I just literally don't understand that argument. I feel like it's just gaslighting.
Yeah, did you hear the interview with the head of the Susan B. Anthony, what is it called, the Susan B. Anthony List?
The Susan B. Anthony Fund,
which is this strongly anti-abortion group, which is dedicated to getting judges on the bench who will overturn Roe, and the head of that organization, who was so impressive and so smart and persuasive and was a great guest on The Daily. But she said, you know, Judge Barrett is our top choice. I mean, they have picked her out because they are pretty sure that she is a vote to do this thing that they long to do. John, I just want to hit the politics of this for a second. When we talked about Barrett's nomination or about Ginsburg's death the other day, originally, before Barrett was nominated, we were unclear about whether this politically helped the president and shook up the presidential campaign at all, and was it going to galvanize conservatives and maybe help his voter turnout operation. Do you have any sense about whether it's having any effect on the race, either helping Biden, helping Trump, animating voters on either side?
I don't know. There is some evidence that it's I mean, it certainly kicked up fundraising for the Democrats, for sure. I mean, there's evidence in the polling that the country would like the decision to be made by the next president. But I don't think there's a lot of evidence this is going to be an animating issue for people who are otherwise undecided by the time they vote. What I think it does do is leave the leave a potential option open still for either successful reaction or a bad overreaction by the opponents. So what would successful action look like? We talked about with the Affordable Care Act, which is to use the public spectacle and abortion and other issues that people think are electorally beneficial for the Democrats, to successfully use the public spectacle of the nomination to drive home a couple of key and important things that mobilize their voters and also set the choice for the presidential election. That's the successful way to do it. The unsuccessful way to do it is to take the bait, essentially, from Republicans who are trying to turn this into an anti-Catholic, anti-woman, or otherwise. That isn't to say that Republicans aren't going to try to use it for those purposes in the same way they've used other instances, but it's to give energy to their effort to bait Democrats, which will be interesting. I really wonder in the end whether, and I think I said this before, whether people think they're not going to, you know, they've gotten all they need to get out of Donald Trump in terms of three seats on the court, like whether this actually diminishes the obsession, not among the people who are constantly obsessed with the court. Three is not enough. But I could totally see a case in which, you know, the promise of future court seats is more powerful than actually having delivered a court seat.
The final point, which maybe is, I don't even know why I make this, but it just really interests me that we have this extraordinary fact that if Barrett is appointed, she will be a Catholic justice replacing a Jewish justice. She would be the sixth Catholic justice in this Supreme Court. Gorsuch, who is the only justice who is neither Catholic nor Jewish, was in fact raised Catholic. And if you look, there have been only 14 Catholic justices in the entire Supreme Court's history and only 8 Jewish justices in the entire Supreme Court history. And so there are, you know, 6 of those justices would be sitting now. 6 of the 14 or 15, if Barrett is appointed, would be sitting currently. And it's extraordinary. And I guess it must have something to do with, like, their very strong Catholic and Jewish legal traditions that must somehow help spur this. But I wonder if you've thought about this at all, Emily, why there is this incredible disproportionality of Jews and Catholics at the highest levels of American legal system.
I mean, I agree it's striking. I don't really know what the explanation for it is, honestly. And I'm not sure how much I think it matters.
I don't know that it matters. I think it's really remarkable. I mean, I think it has to do with they're really, really strong legal.
Well,
and they're Catholic, like very, really strong Catholic law schools that have a kind of Catholic base. Go ahead. Sorry, you were going to say.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm now going to talk about the Jews because I know more about them, that like Judaism is all about law, right? It's like about legal principles. There's a ton of discussion and commentary about law. I mean, maybe there's some connection there. Maybe you're right. I don't know. John,
I think it is.
You have to add?
Culturally super strong among Jews. And I think I'm, sorry, John, go ahead.
Well, I mean, Catholics are basically judicious, wise, restrained, discerning. So it's only natural that they would be in a position of important cultural power.
And maybe you could be the first.
I think the Catholics, there's so many rules you have to follow, and it's all so complicated. And there are so many debates you can have about the tiniest things. So
I mean, think about these two words: Talmudic dispute, Jesuitical. Like these two words, which are when you want to talk about like narrow arguments around very specific issues, which is what the Supreme Court is: Jesuitical, Talmudic.
And one of the reasons I love listening to Thomas Merton's conferences with the novices at Gethsemane is that he is. The intricacies of the things that he's talking about, which are not often about scripture, but about basically the way monks are supposed to behave and the way following Saint Benedict's rule, and it's all so intricate. So, you know, it It seems very much like the law in two important ways. One, a lot of different rules, and then also really open to interpretation and application of brain power to get it right.
Let us go to cocktail chatter when you are having a drink with a Catholic, Jewish, or neither Catholic nor Jewish friend and having a disputatious discussion with them outside this week. What will you be chattering about, Emily Bazelon?
Okay. I am really fascinated by a new study that is associating laws that require car seats with less childbearing.
Yes.
Did you see this?
Yes.
Isn't this totally interesting?
Totally true.
So it's like a data set since 1977. It looks at the state year of variation in laws that require child seats. And it shows that after states mandate car seats, there's a lower probability of giving birth. And so basically the theory is that you can't, it's especially a lower probability of having more than two children.
Yes.
And the theory is you can't fit more than two car seats in the backseat of a car.
Yes.
And so there is a disincentive to have a third child because you can't line up the three car seats. And I guess by the time someone's out of the car seat, then it's sort of too late. And the car seat laws have gone more extended into more years of childhood. And here's the kicker to this. We estimate that these laws prevented only 57 car crash fatalities of children nationwide in 2017. Simultaneously, they led to a permanent reduction of about 8,000 births in the same year and 145,000 fewer births since 1980. So that's a really interesting example of trade-offs, right? So you're preventing the death of a relatively small number of actual children, which is totally great. But you're also preventing all these other kids, it looks like, from being born at all.
Okay.
And so that just changes family
composition. But it's not a one-for-one. Like, the death of a child is not the same as the non-birth of a child. It's not like
those, oh, I
if you'd gotten 58 agree. Births, it wouldn't make it up.
No, I completely agree. Okay. But, like, is there some number at which, like, the future happiness of those potential people matters more? Like, I'm aware that there's another argument if you're in favor of access to abortion that kind of hovers here. But if you're just thinking about trade-offs and, like, the idea, we have a lot of research showing that American parents wish they had more children than they had, that there's this kind of unfulfilled potential for more birth happening in the country. And yet, like, you have this clear protection, anyway, of these born kids, which to me always seems totally primary. But I do think it's, like, just fascinating that you could see that kind of effect.
As the parent of three children, one of the most depressing acts of my entire life was when, soon after my third child was born, was going to the stupid car dealership and buying a stupid fucking minivan. And it was terrible. Because, like, who wants it? It's awful. It's terrible to drive. They're horrible. They're unpleasant in every way a vehicle can be unpleasant. Alienating. So there you go. John, what's your chatter?
I'm just recovering from the contusions you've just laid out there on the minivan. I find them the sleek conveyance through which to go through modern life. It's like the car. It's like the sweatpants of cars, sweatpants of vehicles, the sweatpants without a drawstring of vehicles. My chatter is about a wonderful, wonderful British murder drama called McDonald and Dodds, which I came upon when I was in quarantine before the debate, just sitting in the hotel room on Saturday night, and I discovered it, and it was such a joy. It's about a London detective who comes to Bath and basically gets partnered up with a superintendent who is kind of, they're trying to shove out and who's late in his career, and it's just great. They're doing a second season, but the acting by Atala Gouveia, who plays the woman detective from London, and then Jason Watkins, who plays the quiet, trying to be forced out detective, just a delight. So for people looking for diversions, and the drone shots of Bath don't hurt either. It's just a lovely little, it's a lovely show.
That is
great. And good drama. Oh, and the title again is McDonald and Dodds.
Just added it to my list. My chatter is about an amazing story from New Orleans, which I think was done by Channel 4 News, a local news station there. But It may have been done by others. I'm not sure. And Channel 4, your website is so annoying that I can't actually have the link up because it's constantly auto-playing video, so fix that. But it is about one of the craziest scams I've ever heard of. So there's this well-known scam in insurance where people will, lawyers or people will arrange to get themselves hit by a car in order to make an insurance claim against the driver who hit them. In New Orleans, they have they've taken this, multiplied it, put it on steroids, which is there was a scheme for people to go get themselves hit by 18-wheelers and other big trucks. They would drive on a particular stretch of highway in eastern New Orleans and get themselves hit, cause an accident where they would get themselves hit by an 18-wheeler and then make a medical claim. And there seems to be a scheme with a sort of medical adjuster and then a lawyer who was going to bring the cases, and the medical adjuster and the lawyer are a couple. The lawyer is herself a former stunt woman. Her ads are wild. Her ads on TV are amazing. But there were a huge number of these cases where people just are driving on cars and suddenly they're hit by an 18-wheeler and suddenly they're making a claim to get hundreds of thousands of dollars for their medical, the injuries that have been caused to them. And it's just a really wild story. And it was uncovered in part because what they noticed was that in these accidents where people were getting hit by these 18-wheelers, there would be two or three or four people in the car. And when they looked at the average number of people in the car, it would be 2.6 people on average would be in these cars. And that was so statistically anomalous because, in fact, almost nobody drives in groups. The average number of people in most accidents is about 1.2 because most people are driving alone. And the fact that there were these groups of people who were constantly getting hit by these trucks made them think this is a scam because they're loading up the car. So more people will get injured. More people will be able to make these medical claims. It's an incredible story. Makes you think New Orleans is even weirder than you thought. Listeners, you have tweeted great chatter to us at Slate Gabfest, and please keep them coming. And this week we have something from Megan Murray at MKMurray9. And it's about a story from Alec McGillis in The New Yorker, the students left behind by remote learning. Emily, you can say a little bit about this story.
I thought this was such a well-reported and necessary piece of journalism. I've been feeling like we are not seeing all these kids who are not participating in school because it's remote. They're at home. They are having trouble fully participating or sometimes participating at all. And I think Alec did an amazing job of showing what that's like for the life of one Baltimore student, and also trying to explain why this is happening and why cities like my city, where coronavirus rates are really low, are not having in-person school, the kind of political resistance to that, what it's based on, how much the fears that are behind it of coronavirus are justified, how much they have to do with politics, either a response to President Trump's irresponsible call for reopening everywhere or just local politics. So I really, really recommend this piece in The New Yorker. I thought Alec did an amazing job.
That is our show for today. Dear ones, the GabFest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Gabriel Roth is the editorial director of Slate Podcast. June Thomas, managing producer. Alicia Montgomery, executive producer. Please follow us on Twitter at Slate GabFest and tweet chatter to us. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I am, in fact, David Plotz. We will talk to you next week. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? The Trump tax story got us thinking. One of the things that seems to be going on with Trump's businesses, possibly, is that he has, with his golf courses and some of his hotels, he is running them at an enormous loss every year. And those losses are being used to defray taxes, but they just seem to be really poorly run as businesses. And my thought is that Trump really loves golf. He genuinely loves golf. I think it is clearly his favorite physical activity, and he just is obsessed with it and thinks about it a lot, plays it a ton. And I bet he loves owning golf courses, and golf course is a place where he can schmooze. And so the fact that he's losing money on them may not matter to him that much, but it got us thinking, what if we had enough money that we could be running tax dodges with our own businesses to lose money on them, what would they be? And I have a bunch of thoughts on this, but I wonder if you guys have decided what you would like to lose money on, what great business, what terrible business you'd like to have that would be emotionally or intellectually fulfilling.
Ecotourism. Specifically, I want to own a small,
good one,
like treehouse kind of place where you can, like, you're in the middle of some beautiful magical forest and you get to stay in a treehouse and there are like very lovely guided tours that are, you could like go pick mushrooms or find cool berries and it's all very tasteful and artful. That is, and I get to go live there, of course,
yes,
as much as I want.
Yes.
And also, I want water to be nearby, preferably a lake where I could swim a lot, but also near the ocean so that you could have both.
Love it, Emily. Can I,
good,
can I come?
Right?
Yeah.
Well, you can come.
Can I, to set the terms right, is this for our own personal aggrandizement or or to help the great, because you could imagine just forming a company and taking everybody you know who's uninsured and putting them on the payrolls to insure them, and that would do the greatest good with your swindling. But this is for personal.
I like that earnest answer, John.
But
you
is
go
I'm
with
trying
that.
To okay. Speaks well, then I'll go
you
with that.
That even entered your brain.
That's a,
I was
that's
thinking
a great
purely
one.
Selfish.
That's a great
terms.
One. What does your what does your non business do?
Oh, well,
it's
I guess
in the garbage hauling in New Jersey. No.
Yeah.
How about it makes apple cider donuts?
Okay, it makes apple cider donuts, you see.
GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.